team bomb!
Change has come for America.
Some alien race to come down and threaten us.
Is the singularity near?
The military-industrial complex.
The truth is out there.
The seven mountains of the influencers of culture.
To be as gods, you know,
catapult to propaganda.
From a mostly secure, undisclosed, split-level location on a cul-de-sac somewhere in the heartland of America, this is A View from the Bunker. Now, here's Derek Gilbert.
As it was in the days of Noah is a phrase that's very familiar to those of us who've done any study of prophecy at all. But what happens when you are Noah and you're right smack in the middle of it? Welcome to A View from the Bunker. I'm Derek Gilbert. Our guest is the author of a new book that he describes as prepper fiction, which is appropriate because he is the host of the Prepper Recon podcast at PrepperRecon.com. The book is The Days of Noah, Book One, Conspiracy. It's our pleasure to welcome Mark Goodwin to the program. Mark, thanks for joining us tonight.
Derek, it's such an honor to be here. Thank you.
Well, you're very kind. I'm about halfway through the novel, and the title, of course, is one that will catch the attention of anyone who studies prophecy. And before we get too much into the plot, and of course, we don't want to give too much away. The whole goal is to tease the listener so they want to buy the book or read the book. What is prepper fiction?
Well, I guess I would probably have to credit that to James Wesley Rawls. He wrote a series back about 10, 15 years ago called the Patriot series, and it dealt with economic collapse in America and sort of this total complete collapse of society and all the different systems of support that we're so dependent on now. You know, everything from ATM machines to grocery stores to electricity for the traffic light, and when what happens when all that stuff goes away. And he did a really great in-depth study of that, and it sort of opened up this entire genre of people writing about, you know, what happens when all of these systems of support fail, because we've got so many threats that can actually bring something like that about. We've just seen the attack on Sony, whether it was by North Korea or whether it was some type of government op or whatever it was.
I think it was the Sony.
We know that these types of things can happen.
I think it was the Sony marketing department myself.
I think that very well could be.
Yeah. But be that as it may, you certainly bring a lot into the book, and the novel has a lot of names named in terms of conspiracies, the concepts that are in the book. And I wasn't but two chapters in, and I began to realize, you know, this guy thought a lot like I did when I was writing The God Conspiracy back in 2006. And you know, mine was just sort of let's see if we can work in the course of the story almost every internet conspiracy theory that was out then into the plot, and thought I managed to get a fair number of them in there. When you approached the novel, how much effort did you put into trying to work all of these things in there? I guess what I'm asking is, was this as much about telling a story as it was a clever way to educate people about what's really going on while keeping them entertained?
Well, I think that I'm certainly a professing Christian, but when it comes to conspiracies and what's going to cause the final breakdown, I'm a little bit agnostic on that one. My first series was called the Economic Collapse Chronicles, and it sort of assumes that everything happens due to buffoonery, that the powers that be, the president and the, you know, all the king's horses and all the king's men, Janet Yellen and everybody at the Fed and everybody at the Treasury, they can't get it together and they just can't figure it out. And there's no political will to do the things they need to do to cut the warfare spending and the welfare spending to get us on a sustainable path. And nobody's willing to do that because of the pressure from both sides of the aisle to maintain the status quo. So I did that, and it was a trilogy, and it did very well. And then I wanted to come about this and have a different book. And so this one was, what if everything's planned? And the more I started researching that, the more I started becoming convinced myself that maybe it is. And then I started looking at how that could play into end times prophecy as well.
Hmm. So give us a synopsis of the story. The main character, obviously, as people could guess from the title, The Days of Noah, is Noah Parker and his family. Seems like just a nice enough guy, a Christian who's not really aware of what's going on in the world. What happens to Noah, and how does it change him through the course of the story?
Well, Noah Parker is he's a school teacher, and he's just kind of going through life. He goes to church on Sunday, and he tries to be a good husband and a good father to his kid, he watches Fox News, and he thinks that he's watching conservative programming, and he thinks that he's getting most of the information there, and he understands that there's a lot of fluff, and he just kind of accepts it for whatever it is. His wife Cassie is kind of this internet conspiracy nut, and she's always throwing different theories at him, and he's kind of half-heartedly listening to all of it. Well, one day he gets called to the office, and the sheriff's department's there waiting for him, and he's arrested for violating the community core standards that are instituted in the school where he's at, because he's mentioned creationism, and it starts this whole court battle. And in the meantime, Department of Children and Family Services comes to his house, takes his daughter, because now he's being accused of a crime against children because he's mentioned creationism in a public school classroom. Mm. And if you'll Google, dog shot by police, there's on YouTube, there's going to be thousands and thousands of incidents, because that's just typically what the police do when they kick in a door. The first thing they do, if there's an animal there, they just shoot it. They just don't even think about it. They don't give the owners an opportunity to go put it in the bathroom or lock it up or do anything like that. They just shoot it. Mm-hmm. And so when the police come to take his daughter, they shoot his dog. A representative from Department of Children and Family Services comes in and collects evidence against the mother, who's a homeschooler, because she has some unapproved homeschooling materials from Ron Paul. Mm. So, and then the child's taken, and his entire life just kind of breaks down in that one day, and it just completely forces him to open his eyes and see what's really going on.
10 years ago, and maybe even 8 years ago, while I was writing The God Conspiracy, I would have thought that the story of the Parkers was perhaps a little too implausible. And mine was weird enough, in that a young boy gets an email that wasn't intended for him, and suddenly he's being pursued by, guys dressed in black. But the news over the last 8 years, we see stories that aren't really that much farther, that much more outrageous that much less outrageous than what you just described as part of the plot of The Days of Noah. For example, the family down in Arkansas recently that had their children taken away because of an anonymous complaint. There's some hint that it might have been one of the teenagers in the family. He was kind of upset that they were being homeschooled instead of sent to public school. Don't know for a fact. But all the children were taken away by Children and Family Services, and the parents are left standing there with no recourse.
Yeah, and there was the California couple a couple of years ago where the doctor said he wanted to operate right away on their child, and they said, no, we want to get a second opinion. And Child Services stepped in on that one. And there was the little girl in the Northeast that it took her parents, I think, 2.5 years to get her back. And while she was in the care of the state, her health just deteriorated, and probably if they hadn't gotten her back, she may very well have died. And that was all over. The doctor had misdiagnosed her and had her on some type of medication, and another doctor saw her and said she's been misdiagnosed and accused the parents of child abuse because another doctor had misdiagnosed her. And so the state has really just stepped in and has assumed this all-encompassing role of authority over every single area of our life, whether it's defining marriage or whether it's telling us what we can and can't eat. And I think with Obamacare, I think we're going to see a lot more of that, because now that the state's going to be responsible for taking care of our health bills once they've bankrupted all the insurance companies, which I think is probably the plan of Obamacare. I think that they'll feel like they have carte blanche to tell us what we can eat and what we can drink and how many calories we can consume, and and if we don't live according to their standards, then we won't be given health care.
Yeah, it's funny that we're having this conversation, because just this afternoon I was talking to our daughter who's about to turn 25, and because of our change that's upcoming, I'm having to lose employer-supplied health care for the first time. I mean, I basically, since I was 22, 30 years, I've basically had health care provided through an employer at a fairly reasonable cost, although the cost has increased pretty substantially the last 4 or 5 years. Unfortunately, because of this move, we're going through the exchange right now, and it's ridiculous, as middle-class people, because of the way the law was written, families up to four times the federal poverty level qualify for tax credits. I mean, I feel ridiculous here. I mean, I'm sitting in a room with some wonderful technology and I qualify for tax credits based on my income level. And my daughter, who is struggling to make ends meet working a couple of part-time jobs, is suddenly hit with a, you know, realization. She's having to go out for healthcare, her health insurance for the first time herself, and running into the labyrinth that is the Obamacare healthcare exchange or health insurance exchange. And we had this very same conversation about, you know, where this is all going to lead, government control over what you can put into your body, because now it's a national issue because it costs everybody money. When you began writing this, Mark, coming at this from a background as a prepper, and let me back up a step here to lay some groundwork there. When did you start beginning your, I don't know if career is the right word, but when did you start to believe that preparing for breakdown of society or economy or whatever was a really wise idea, and start focusing attention on it through your work in the podcast and your website?
I grew up in Kentucky, and both of my grandparents had farms, and I saw them living this sort of self-sustaining type of a lifestyle, or God-sustaining type of lifestyle, we should say, because they were all Christians and had great faith, but they were very, very in touch with the land and had lived through the Depression, and they sort of had that country boy will survive type of mentality. And and then I went into Boy Scouts, which the model there was be prepared, which kind of stuck with me all through life. But you know, as time went on, I kind of just melted into just the social norm of things. And then September 11th was a big wake up call, as I think it was for a lot of people, to see, you know, how radically fast our society changed in a matter of minutes, and it did change. And, you know, we've never come back from that, as far as the surveillance state and the NDAA and the Patriot Act and all of the things that have come against our liberty. But, you know, there for weeks, you know, there were no planes. the markets were closed down. People that had, certain types of accounts weren't able to access their money, and because they were tied to the markets, and I saw the type of chaos that could erupt very, very quickly, and so I sort of started thinking about it about then, but then sort of got lulled back to sleep until the 2008 crash, and then the 2008 crash scared me more than 9/11, because 9/11. Well, at the time, I thought I understood that, well, these people hate us because we're free. You know, that didn't make a whole lot of sense, but that's what all the mainstream media's news stations were telling me. So right. I guess I bought it. And so they want to kill us because we're free. And so I could understand that. But when 2008 happened, I could not understand what was a CDO? What's subprime debt? You know, how did this all happen? How did our entire monetary system almost collapse? So I actually went to school for accounting after that, and just started reading everything that I could about the crisis. And Didn't learn a whole lot in college about it, but through self-education, I started to kind of get a grasp of, you know, this is what happens, and this is, you know, the big banks have been turned into casinos, and Goldman Sachs had both sides of the bet on the subprime CDOs. They were selling the long side and then taking huge short positions while telling everybody that it was AAA rated debt, and they just cleaned up on it, and so there were a lot of people that really understood it well. But I didn't, and that scared me more than anything. And then in understanding that, and understanding what we've tried to do to correct it, it makes me more scared, because what we've tried to do to correct it is absolutely nothing. We've printed trillions and trillions of dollars, and we've gotten more and more debt as a nation, and we've done nothing to reform the lending standards. You know, you can still go to Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac and get a 3% down loan for a house, or a 10% down loan for an investment loan, and absolutely nothing's changed. We were told that one of the problems was that the banks were too big to fail. Well, they've sandwiched them together, and now they're too bigger to fail.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Coming through that educational process with the background in self-sufficiency, or the example of self-sufficient, or as you say, God sufficiency, which is really a better way of putting it, you saw from your grandparents. What kind of research did you need to do for the novel The Days of Noah, as far as Common Core, or as you call it, Community Core in the novel, and some of the other things that you weave in? I mean, because just here's my partial list of the conspiracy that you brought into the book: 9/11, the economic collapse that you just described, Common Core, militarization of our police forces, the total surveillance state, radical secularism, the war on homeschoolers, which is sort of an extension of the radical secularist movement in our country. Then you get into some of the secret societies like the Skull and Bones and Freemasons. And again, that's just a partial list off the top of my head. How much research did you have to put into those things, and what did you learn the most about during your research?
Wow. Hundreds and hundreds of hours of research. So, and it started probably back when I was writing the first series. And, I guess I'm always kind of researching the next series, you know, mm-hmm. But, what did I learn the most about? I don't know. I just keep learning. I think I'm a serial learner. So, you know, that's something that there's not a whole lot of TV shows that I really like. I don't like sports, but I love learning, and I love learning anything about money and government. And then when I started in the Bible and prophecy and things like that, and then when I started getting into some of the darker stuff in just kind of coming across some of these videos as I was researching the economics and the things that were sort of on the face and not so conspiratorial, I started thinking, well, that can't be true. And so there's no way George Bush is a member of some dark secret society. But then, you know, you look it up on YouTube, and there he is on NBC mm-hmm. telling the reporter, you know, yes, I'm a member of Skull and Bones, and it's so secret I can't even talk about it. And then the next video that comes up is John Kerry talking to the same reporter. Yes, I'm a member of Skull and Bones, and it's too secret. We can't talk about it. And I'm thinking, there's two people from the same. There was no way to not have a member of Skull and Bones running the country in that election. And you know, now John Kerry is the Secretary of State, so you know he's still essentially very, very involved in directing foreign policy. And then when you start to look at all of the other organizations that sort of work around that, the Bilderberg Organization and the Trilateral mm-hmm. Organization and the Council on Foreign Relations, it's you know, if you had a wall with everybody that's in the administration right now or connected to government right now, it'd be hard to throw a dart and not hit one that wasn't in one of those organizations. And Henry Kissinger is linked to just about every single one of them.
Yep.
And so is David Rockefeller.
Right. Now, we used to have a whiteboard like that in our basement in back in St. Louis, a 4x8 whiteboard with you know, names and arrows and circles and diagrams and links. And our daughter.
Oh, I need one of those. I really need one of those. Oh, yeah. I just want to do it with the thumbtacks and the yarn and just go to town. Crazy.
Oh yeah, yeah. We did that, and our daughter, you know, was in middle school at the time. Brought her friends over, and I remember watching. She had a couple of friends over, and young boy, you know, maybe 12 years old, looks at it, and he looks at me and Sharon, and we look like, you know, just average people you'd see at Walmart or something. And he said, "Your parents are so cool." And our daughter just said, "Yeah, that's the wall of paranoia." So it was, but you're right. The odds against these sorts of connections happening by accident are pretty small. But yeah, that's the way society is always kind of organized, I suppose. You know, those in power tend to like to bring their friends along with them, you know, for the ride. But there is more going on behind the scenes than we are apprised of, and sometimes it just up and smacks people in the head and catches them by surprise. Now, interesting that you named Noah's wife Cassandra, because, of course, in mythology, she was the princess of Troy, who was cursed by the god Apollo with the gift of prophecy, but no one would ever believe her, which
That's
is
right.
kind of what happens in the novel, as she's telling the Bible study about what she knows, and the people in the Bible study are like, "Yeah, right, let's go for snacks." Why did you write it that way, where Noah, the protagonist, is sort of the clueless one, and his wife is the one who is, you know, really aware of what's going on? I mean, interesting that, you know, here he is a public school teacher, and yet they're homeschooling their daughter because they don't want him in the public schools. You would think, you know, is that a comment on the state of most Americans who think they're good conservative Christians?
Yeah, I think it could be. But, you know, when I started getting into the vein of prepping, I sort of – and when I wrote my first novel, my first series, The American Exit Strategy, Economic Collapse Chronicles, I really had in mind that preppers were about 90, maybe at least 85% male. And that it was going to be mostly, you know, the wives that sort of put up with it and dealt with the guns and the you know, bags of rice and, you know, buying the silver and the gold and all of that kind of thing that goes along with the beans, bullets, and band-aids, we like to call it.
Yeah.
And it's not that way at all. And when I started – and when the book started selling, it was – the people, especially the people that are buying the book and reading the books – it's more women than men.
Mm-hmm.
And so, in the first series, the main protagonist was the male, and he was kind of the one that was the traditional prepper and leading that. And so I kind of wanted to tell that other story for all of those readers out there, for all of the female preppers out there that are the ones that have to sort of coax their husbands along, because their husband's not taking that leadership role of, you know, of providing for their family. You know, when in Timothy, when it says, you know, he that doesn't provide for his own family mm-hmm. is worth than a pagan or unbeliever, you know, that provision is not just monetary. It's not just putting food in the refrigerator and a roof over your heads. You know, you have to do everything you can to provide a stable political system by being involved in politics. You have to provide for your family's security, because 911 can't do that. Mm-hmm. You know, 911 is for calling for somebody to come out and fill out a report, and, you know, maybe they catch the guy and maybe they don't, and most likely they don't. In Detroit right now, a high priority 911 call takes 58 minutes to respond to. So unless the perpetrator is going to sit down and watch a movie with you and have a bowl of popcorn, there's no way the cops are going to get there before he leaves.
Yeah, good point. And yet sometimes when they do show up, as you illustrate in the book with a very tragic story, the first encounter where they come into the Parker home with the representative for Child and Family Services, it escalates very, very quickly. How militarized has our police forces become in recent years?
Well, I think we've seen it in the Boston bombing. We saw an entire police force, and I was just appalled that there weren't members of that department that just laid down their badges. But instead, what they did is they went house to house doing searches, pulling every class of person you can imagine out of their homes at gunpoint, walking them down the street, frisking them, you know, and these are, 60-year-old men, 50-year-old ladies, you know, they're looking for a 19-year-old kid. And, you know, they had a very, very specific description of what they were looking for. And none of the people that you see them in these videos after the Boston bombing of pulling these people out of their house, none of these people look like the 19-year-old kid they're looking at. But they've all got AR-15s trained on them, telling them, hands up, hands up. And they're getting frisked, which I would think if there was ever a time in the history of the United States that you wanted your populace to be armed, it would be when there's this mad bomber on the loose, right? Isn't that the reason that you're kicking the doors in the first place? You should want them to be armed. You know, that's their job. The Second Amendment basically puts us in charge of our own security and in the security of the state. And it's not the job of the police to do that. And it's certainly not their job to just run roughshod over the Constitution, the Fourth Amendment of kicking in doors with no warrants and house to house warrantless searches. I think that was just absolutely appalling. And it made me, from the conspiratorial side of things, it made me wonder, did that happen in Boston because that was a populace that was already so liberal, so trained that you should just bow down to anything the state tells you, that's why they picked to do it there? Because, you know, would that have happened? Would that have looked the same as if it would have happened in Texas? Would they have done the same things in Georgia?
Probably not certain parts of Missouri either, based on my experience. But we saw the same thing happen in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina.
Yeah, we saw police shipped in from states all over to go house to house collecting guns. So that's not something that's conspiracy of house to house warrantless searches and house to house warrantless gun confiscation. That's not conspiracy. That's history.
Mm. You talk at some length here, and some of the other protagonists in the book are actually involved on the other side. And by the way, before we continue on, should point out that you did take care, and I caught this and was glad to see it, because with some police officers in among our friends and family members, not all police officers are ready to kick in your door in violation of your constitutional rights, and you made a point of showing that in the book, a couple of the characters giving up jobs with the police in protest over what's going on. The other characters come from the intelligence community, sort of the ones who are responsible for the total surveillance state, or at least maintaining the total surveillance under which we live here in the United States. And again, you've got somebody, as with those police officers who aren't happy with what's going on, a career operative inside the CIA decides he's had enough. What inspired that character for in your mind? Why did you choose to have a character like that in the book? What role does he play?
I think that he's the quintessential good guy that ends up in that role and just sort of keeps bending his morals little by little. And you know, he ends up being tied up in an operation funding the CIA, because all the black ops for the CIA, you can't go ask Congress to fund a black op. So how do they fund these things? Well, by ripping off drug dealers and selling drugs. That's how they fund themselves.
Oh, yeah. I got to add that conspiracy to the list here. Okay.
Yeah. And so he ends up doing that on the Tajikistan border, and gets shot and then ends up in the working as a overseer for analysts because he can't work in the field anymore because of his war injury. And, you know, and he's a good guy. He thinks that everything he's done is for the good of the country, but he starts stumbling into all of these things that just start not adding up. And because of the compartmentalization, I think that you really have so many of those people out there that really believe in the cause and they really think they're doing the right thing. Because I think that that's how most Americans are. And I think it's this slow trickle, systematic brainwashing that's convinced them to support the roles that they've supported. And I wanted to tell that story as well.
Yeah. And again, I'm only about halfway through the novel, but I sort of caught the arc in the direction that was going. And again, glad to see that. There's a movie that I need to watch again because it's more than just a kind of campy monster movie. And that is the movie They Live, which starred the former pro wrestler Rowdy Roddy Piper, Keith David, excellent black actor. But it also has a character actor, one of those guys when you see him in a movie, it's like, oh yeah, that guy named Buck Flowers, who has a little monologue toward the end of the film. And basically the premise of the movie is that Piper stumbles onto these sunglasses that when he puts them on, allows him to see that not everything is what he thinks it is. It allows him to see beyond the disguise of a race of aliens that have basically come down and enslaved humanity without humanity even knowing it. And now that he's aware that something is very, very wrong, he can't go back to the way it was before. And this guy, Buck Flowers, who was sort of a panhandler bum in the early part of the movie, shows up toward the end of the movie wearing a tuxedo and at this fancy, because he's basically turned informant for the aliens. And he's got this speech where he says, I just want a taste of the good life. Come on. All you got to do is give in. Everybody does it. And I think that speech is so relevant for where we are today. And for the way you describe many of the people, or at least this character, the CIA character, you know, just kind of bending his morals little by little by little by little just to get along. How prevalent do you see that attitude, that spirit in America?
The go along to get along attitude,
yeah,
is that what
just
you're talking about?
Because
that is so, and unfortunately, I think the place that attitude is most prevalent is the church. Because I don't think that, I think the rest of the society, I think, don't have that much of a conviction to know that what they're doing is wrong. But I see so much of it in pastors that are unwilling to get involved in the fight politically, you know, whether it's because of their 501c3 or 401k, they want to be more seeker friendly or whatever the excuse is. You know, did you read the story about the 3,288 American children that were murdered today in the paper?
No.
No, I didn't either, because it wasn't in the paper.
Ah, okay.
But it happened in abortion clinics all over America.
Right. Okay. Yes.
And it's going to happen again tomorrow, and it's going to happen the day after tomorrow, and it's going to keep happening every single day. And we've got pastors that are afraid to get in the political fight, and that's why it keeps happening.
Yeah. And again, it's because they want to live a comfortable life. Getting involved might mean taking a risk and finding yourself out of a job, out of a pulpit, out of a, you know, not on a paycheck, nothing being contributed to the retirement plan. Not only in the church, well, it happens all over, but at least in the church, you would think there would be some incentive. I mean, serving the creator of the universe would be more of an incentive, to do what's right than, you know, to just try to get along. I mean, ultimately, you're going to have to answer to an authority, and it's not going to be what was Al Gore's statement? Relevant legal authority, or whatever the word was when he tried to justify the donations from the Chinese backers at the Buddhist temple. Mm. Anyway, why is that? I mean, is it just fear of the loss of power, money, whatever? I mean, why has the church become so wishy-washy, do you think?
I'm not sure. And I think that some of it is that they don't want to believe things are that bad. You know, Martin Niemöller was a pastor in Nazi Germany. And he didn't really get involved in the fight until later on, when it became so obvious that the things that were being done to the Jews and the concentration camps and the murders and the eugenics and the sterilization of anybody that was deemed to not be perfect. And he's the one that had the quote, and I can't remember the whole thing perfectly, but it went something like, you know, first they came for the trade unions, right, yeah, and I didn't say anything because I wasn't a trade unionist. And then they came for the Jews, and I didn't say anything because I wasn't a Jew. Mm-hmm. And then they came for me, and nobody said anything because there was no one left.
Yeah. Let's shift to the economics of this a little bit. You talk in your Prepper podcast about financial preparedness and where to, and in the book as well, the Days of Noah. There's quite a bit in there about the financial shenanigans at the global level and the preparations that people can take. The part of the plot revolves around an attempt by the BRICS nations: Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, to establish a common currency, and what that might do to the economy of the United States. That was an interesting thing, because I've not really studied that much, even though, degree in economics, but just a bachelor's. What would that mean to the United States if those up and coming economies, economic powers, were to just kind of reject the U.S. dollar and come up with their own trading currency?
Well, it's already happened. They've already established their intent to have the bank, and it's going to be based in China, to have that international trade settlement bank between Russia and China and Brazil, India, and South Africa. I guess it was a year, or maybe it was 2 years ago, that China called for the de-Americanization of the economy. And, they're tired of seeing us with the reserve currency. We don't really export much other than, a little bit of corn and some surplus food, but wheat, I think. But we don't export that much except debt. Pornography. Mm-hmm. We're the number one exporter of pornography in the world, is America.
Figures.
But by printing these trillions of dollars and into the reserve currency, we're devaluing all of these other countries' foreign reserve holdings. Let's say, I'm preaching to the choir by telling you this, but just for the sake of the listeners out there, let's say you've got a really simple economy and you've got 10 pizzas and $10, and that's the only thing that exists in this economy. Well, each pizza is how much? It's a dollar, right?
Right.
Now, if I print 10 more dollars, now all of a sudden I've got $10, and that's in addition to everybody else's dollars, but we still only got 10 pizzas. So now each pizza is worth what?
Yeah, we raised the price of the pizza to $2.
$2.
And it's not that the pizza costs
now,
more.
What I did.
Yeah.
So now I've got all this value. I have $10. I've actually got 5 pizzas worth of value. But where did that value come from? Because it didn't appear magically out of the air. I stole that value from the other people that had the other $10. Mm-hmm. And the rest of the world's getting tired of that.
Yeah. Basically, China has bought our debt and we owe them a certain amount of money. But by printing more dollars, each of those dollars becomes worth less. So we're paying them back in dollars that are worth less than they were when China bought the debt. That would tick me off, too, if I were them.
Mm-hmm.
So how big to what lengths would the United States go to prevent the dollar from being knocked off the top of the pile as the world's de facto reserve currency?
Well, I think we're seeing that right now. A lot of people will say, well, 1971, we pulled the gold standard, and ever since then, the dollar's been backed by nothing. It's just a fiat currency. And I would argue with those people and say it's not backed by anything. It's backed by lead.
And that, yeah,
and I think that North Korea just got to see a little bit about the different things that you can do with lead. We can shut your internet off,
mm-hmm.
and you know, and I think that that it's the just the bully pulpit is what it's backed by now. So, but there's a limit to that as well.
Yeah, and the agreement in the early 70s, you know, I think a lot of people assume that the OPEC oil embargo of what was it 72, 73 was about trying to squeeze the West for more money, and I think really what it was about was about getting the it was a mutual back scratching deal, but what it resulted in was the Saudis agreeing to only sell their oil in dollars, which kind of forced the rest of OPEC to go along with it. So in a sense, isn't the dollar backed by oil?
Yeah, in a way it is. And you know who set that agreement up, right?
Henry Kissinger.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah.
and then our side of that, since they agree to do that, we agree to prop up the Saudi kings militarily. And of course this is a regime where they just recently arrested about 15 people for having a home Bible study. If you're a Muslim and you convert to Christianity in Saudi Arabia, you can be executed, mm-hmm. imprisoned, beat, whipped. They don't allow their women to drive, which, you know, I'm not saying that might not be that bad of an idea, but
don't go there.
Whoops. What did I say that out loud? But you know, when we talk about freedom and wanting to spread democracy, you know, that's the brand of freedom and democracy that we're spreading with our tax dollars. Hmm.
Let's shift over to another topic here. The Parker family in the novel The Days of Noah are homeschooling, and under the and in the story, not only is Noah, who's a high school teacher, required to teach community core, but the homeschoolers are also required to teach according to these community core standards. I assume this is based on a Common Core. What do you see as the threat of this curriculum, this style of education that is being pushed on the states by the Department of Education?
We're already seeing in California that homeschoolers are having to use state-approved material, so that's pretty close to what's already going on. There's so many things in Common Core to the just taking common sense completely out of the equation and not training children to do critical thinking and to think through problems and actually training them to just score well on tests and basically to do very little more than robots, and they're not expected much more than that out of them. And I think probably the worst things that could possibly be put into an education system are already there, and that's telling them that they descended from a monkey and teaching them, because that's a brand of atheism, isn't it? Because if you descended from a monkey, then that means that the Bible's wrong and that the Bible's a lie. And you don't have to come out and say your pastor's lying to you, your mother and your father are lying to you, God didn't make you, you came from a monkey. You don't have to say all the other parts. All you have to say is you came from a monkey, and all those other things are implied. And so I think that, you know, teaching children atheism, which has been in the school system for so long, I think that's the most damaging thing we could have ever possibly done. And I think that that's what our society is reaping, what we've sown there in all these children that come up with no purpose. And I'm not divine, you know, I wasn't knit together in my mother's womb, and it's not a life until the state says it's a life. So it's just a blob until they determine that it's a life, and the state's God. And I think that we're reaping the benefit, the curse of that in all of the violence that we're seeing and kids that just don't care.
Hmm. So the Common Core, beyond the teaching of now let me back up again and rephrase that, removing God from the classroom, which really began in the early 60s when a prayer mm-hmm. was taken out of schools, has been ongoing. That's been a battle that we've been losing for the last 50 years. And now, as you point out, in California, which usually leads the way in trends like this, it's they're forcing this into the home as well. To what end? I mean, what is the purpose of the teaching to the test, or, you know, just training kids to do well on tests and be good little robots? What benefit is that to the state?
Well, you build a compliant society that's willing to roll over and give up their liberties and their rights and allow you to print all the value out of their money without asking for an audit of the Fed, right? And then also, you know, Common Core has I think that U.S. history starts sometime around the 60s. So they've conveniently gotten rid of everything about those pesky folks that started this country, those people that are now being termed as terrorists by the FBI.
Mm. Yeah, somebody posted something to Facebook tonight that I thought was very appropriate. If you think the same way Thomas Jefferson did, you're now considered a right-wing radical in the United States. You mentioned something earlier, and I made a note of this phrase because I don't know if I've heard it elsewhere, but it seemed very apropos, the warfare welfare state. Does that pretty much describe what drives the American economy these days?
That's our entire economy, I think, and each side of the aisle has their pet in that. And to maintain the status quo, the other one will give concessions to allow the other ones to live. And there's you know, nobody's going to the chopping block. But I think that both of those institutions have to be drastically reduced for us to ever get on a sustainable path economically. Mm-hmm. You know, the right wants to continue our influence around the entire world with the military, and then the left wants to keep allowing people to be comfortable in their poverty. As Benjamin Franklin said, he said, you know, don't let people be comfortable in their poverty. And when you keep incentivizing people to not do anything, then they'll find that it's easier and it's more rewarding to stay home and collect the checks,
yeah,
and to you know, figure out a way to game the welfare system than it is to actually get up and get out and go to work.
Yeah, here,
and then that system just kind of feeds on itself because they beget children that have no purpose, that are sort of have this mentality that I was just bred almost like cattle. I'm a cash, you know, I'm a cash cow. I'm just I'm livestock. You know, mm-hmm. My mom gets a check for me, so you know that's why I'm here. And then they go out and do the same thing. So.
Yeah,
that's like, not sustainable.
No, it's like my dad said. The truth of the matter is, if you're trying to manage people, you often don't get any production out of them until you apply some stress to them, make it very clear that it's in their best interest to get up off the couch. And you know, that description fits me as well. A lot of jobs that I'm taking care of now in the next week or so because we're getting ready to try to sell the house that I should have been doing in the last 4 years that we've lived here. So anyway, well, let's end this on more of an up note. Your podcast, PrepperRecon.com, is about how to prepare for this. I mean, short of emigrating to Costa Rica or you know, Panama or something to reduce our cost of living and you know, maybe get some better weather too. What can we do to survive and thrive inside this climate that is building around us?
Well, I think that Reagan said, if we lose freedom here, it's lost everywhere. So I don't know if there's anywhere else left to hide or left to run, you know, Costa Rica or anywhere like that. Those places are great when you go and you're the rich gringo. But what happens when all the currencies around the world fail, you mm-hmm. know, and now you're the person that's not part of their original community. So,
yeah,
you know, if it turns to cannibalism, you're probably going to be the first one in the pot. But I have a 7-step survival plan, and that's on the left-hand side of Prepper Recon, and people can click that. And that's designed for people that are just waking up to the need to be prepared and that want to start taking some actions in case, you know, like I said, we lose those systems of support that we're so dependent on. And, you know, most cities have about 3 days worth of food in them, and all the grocery stores are ran on just in time inventory, where when we get down to three cans of peas, then we'll order another case of peas. But there's no stock room in the back of the grocery store anymore with 18 cases of peas, you know. So
yeah.
And then those 3 days, it doesn't mean that there's 3 days for everybody. It means there's 3 weeks for the first six people that get there and nothing for everybody else. Mm-hmm. So that's how that works.
Yeah. Amazon.com is not going to be able to supply.
I live in Florida, and I get to see that every time there's a threat of a hurricane. You know, the first 10 people in the store, you know, they're all stocked up and everybody else is, you know,
out of luck. Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah. Well, and again, Amazon.com is not going to be able to supply us all forever, unfortunately. What is, just say, is some common, just some basic common sense type preparation tips that you would suggest? I mean, you know, maybe somebody's looking at the list and saying, oh, you know, this is just too much. I don't even know where to start. It's too overwhelming. I'll think about it tomorrow, and then tomorrow, and tomorrow, and tomorrow, and it never comes. What would you suggest? It's just some good basic common sense things to prepare.
Well, I've got a list of seven, and the first one is body, mind, and soul. And that is, you know, number one, getting your body, getting yourself right. And that's, you know, getting in shape, because if you can't, we had several people die of heart attacks in that first snowstorm up in the Northeast this year.
Oh, yeah.
Because, you know, they've been sitting on the couch all year, and then you get out and you go think you're going to shovel 6 feet of snow and you keel over and die.
Yeah.
Because you're not in shape to do it. So number one, you got to take care of yourself, and you need to get in shape and your mind, and that's reading and learning. And, you know, it might mean turning off the, you know, American Idol or whatever to get on the internet and watch some videos about prepping or learn to garden or learn to do some canning or learn some skills. And your soul, you know, Jesus said, what is it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses his own soul? Well, the prepper translation of that might be, what does it matter if you have all the beans, bullets, and Band-Aids and you can survive the zombie apocalypse, but you don't know that you're going to go to heaven when you die? You know, statistically, we know that 10 out of 10 people die. So you got to be ready for judgment day. So that's number one, is that body, mind, and soul. That's getting yourself ready. Number two, it's not really that sexy either. It's budget. You know, make sure that you're living on less than you're bringing in, so that you're putting something away for a rainy day, and, you know, start putting aside a good cash cushion. And I recommend, I think Dave Ramsey says 6 months of your expenses in cash. He'll tell you to keep that in the bank. I'll tell you to buy a safe and keep a couple of months of that somewhere in your house, because when the grid goes down, if we lose power, or if the banks get hacked, or if we have a bail-in like they had in Cyprus, or if we have a banking holiday like they had in, like they almost had in Russia a couple of weeks ago, when the currency dropped 30% in one day.
Mm-hmm.
Or if we have bank riots like they had in 2001 in Argentina, you're not going to go to the bank and get your money out. So it's either going to be in your house in a safe, or you're not going to get it. And there's been all types of banking reform rules passed that are all not in the interest of the depositor, but in the interest of the bank.
Right.
And you're just not going to get it.
Yeah. If you've got a large sum in the bank, good luck going and getting it all. When you want to pull it out, it'll be like that scene from It's a Wonderful Life, when there's the run on the savings and loan, or building and loan, where because Jimmy Stewart's uncle forgot to make the deposit, and suddenly everybody was panicked and trying to get their money out, and it just wasn't there. Banks are doing that these days, aren't they? They've been putting limits on how much you can pull out at a single time.
Most branch banks have about $15,000 in there Monday through Thursday. They'll get a little bit more. They might double it on Friday for paydays. But because very few people transact in cash, most of them have very little cash. And if you're going to take out more than $5,000 or $10,000, you're going to have to call ahead and schedule that, and probably a couple of weeks ahead of time. So if you think you're going to go pull $30,000 out of your little branch the day that it all falls apart, guess again, that's not going to happen.
Hmm.
Now, the third thing is to put together a bug out bag. And now this is good for if you have a fire in your house and you have to grab something, you know where everything's at in there. and you've got 3 days worth of food. You've got some type of shelter in there. You've got some way method of purifying water. You've got a flash drive in there that you've scanned all of your pertinent documents. You've got all your insurance information on there. You've got copies of all your credit cards. You've got your marriage license in there. You've got copies of your passport and your driver's license and your house deed and all of your 401k information. You've got all that stuff scanned, and that's on a flash drive, and it's in that bug out bag. So if there's a fire, you at least have your essential documents in there, and you've got a change of clothes, and you've got something to eat, and a tent, some things like that, a flashlight, and it's just some basic things in there. And now you should also have 3 days of food in there. So that's, you know, if there's a chemical spill or a terrorist attack near you, that you have to get out of the area, because the roads clog up really fast. If you live in a metropolitan area, you can't get anywhere at 5:30, you know. So if you think that everybody's going to leave the city at one time, when a disaster hits, that just doesn't happen. It doesn't happen at 5:30 during rush hour. So why would it happen in a disaster when it's everybody, not just the people that got off at 5? So. Yeah.
And again, if people remember back 10 years, just remember those pictures of and video of people trying to get out of New Orleans ahead of Katrina.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. It's the people that leave first. Those people will get out, and everybody else is just going to be in the parking lot.
Yeah. Yeah. It's sort of like a Ponzi scheme in that regard. First one out is the only one who wins. And that, you know, happened even with NBC News anchor Brian Williams out there bravely directing traffic on the interstate out of town. It was he did all he could, but it just wasn't enough.
Saving puppies and going to the moon. And
that's right.
It directs traffic.
What a guy. And I think I know the answer to this last question because of point number one on your list of recommended things there at PrepperRecon.com. And you address this in the novel of The Days of Noah. I mean, the real power behind the organized chaos that is developing around us, the economic chaos, the radical secularist government that is encroaching on our lives, especially those Christians who dare to teach their own children things that are not approved by the state. Who are the real powers behind that that conspiracy?
Well, I think it's Satan. And I think that whether it's Skull and Bones or the Illuminati or the Bilderbergers or the Nazis or the Egyptian kings, it's always been Satan that has sought to take one group and make them feel like they're vastly more important than everybody else and reveal all of these secrets and things to them and sell them on his lies. And get them to oppress the rest of the populace. Mm.
Powers and principalities and rulers of spiritual darkness. Mark Goodwin is the author of the new novel, The Days of Noah, Book One, Conspiracy. He's also the host of the Prepper Recon podcast. Mark, where do people find the novel, and how do they find out more about what you're doing and where your podcast is?
Well, if you go to PrepperRecon.com, I've got two posts that go up every Monday and every Wednesday. We put a new show on there, and we deal with everything from beans, bullets, and Band-Aids to economics and liberty-related issues and everything else. And I get a lot of great prepper guests from all around the world to help everybody prepare for everything from a hurricane to the end of the world as we know it. And there's links to all of my books on PrepperRecon.com. I've also got a store there. We've got great first aid kits there that have got everything that you would need to address traumatic injuries. That's one of the things that a lot of people they'll get the beans, they'll get a nice store of food put away, they'll get the bullets, they'll have the guns, they'll be able to defend themselves. But a lot of people kind of skimp on the Band-Aids, and when everything falls apart, if there's no hospitals and you have to take care of yourself, then you have to either have that. It's like an insurance policy. You either have to have that stuff before you need it or you don't get it at all. And so all of that's there, and it's PrepperRecon.com, and we also replicate all of the podcasts to YouTube as well.
All right. Mark Goodwin, fascinating stuff. And again, interesting reading a novel that tracking along the lines that where my mind was going, almost 10 years ago in looking at this. And hard to believe we've been talking about these issues on this podcast, this and PID Radio for the last 10 years. Look forward to talking with you again, because this is good stuff. I appreciate it.
Derek, thanks so much for having me on the show. It's really been a pleasure.
And of course, you'll find a link to Mark's website, PrepperRecon.com, in the show notes at VFTB.net. And I will be a guest on the Prepper Recon podcast, in fact, next week. We'll be recording that next week. Got a little bit of time as we're in the interim period between travel for my current employer. I'm still technically employed through the end of this month, and relocating to Southwest Missouri for the, to actually get hands-on and sleeves rolled up for Skywatch TV. So next week, we're actually going to be taking advantage of some of the time during the day around a few last little fix-up jobs around the house to guest on the Prepper Recon podcast. And Sharon and I together will also appear on the Supernatural Christian podcast with Patricia Longer. And we will post links to those, of course, at the usual locations, Twitter and Facebook. And I'll give you the feed addresses on those in just a couple of minutes. Just a couple of things this week to point out, and this is really relates to the topic of the book that of Mark's novel, The Days of Noah. We saw a few years ago in the movie Minority Report a glimpse of what it would look like when the government tries to predict what you're thinking and arrest you before you can do something in a department of pre-crime, which adds a new spin to the thought crimes of Orwell's 1984. This is happening now. So-called fight cams have been installed at certain locations in the UK using closed-circuit television cameras to keep under surveillance certain areas where violence or criminal activity are more likely to break out, and to try to predict using software paired with these CCTV cameras to predict when something is about to happen and notify police early. This is developed by Cardiff University in Wales, and being employed over there and tested over there to as an aid to policing again higher crime areas there. But we will certainly see it here in the U.S. as well, and that is the direction that things are going. Not only now is it enough to run afoul of the law just by thinking or tweeting or speaking or writing or posting something that falls outside the bounds of what is acceptable, but it won't be long before we see computers used to try to predict based on your activity online or things that you might be doing or seen doing on a CCTV camera somewhere. To try to predict whether or not you'll be a threat to national security and then arrested. Speaking of security, the violence continues in the Middle East, and was exchanging some email tonight back and forth with John Holler, who reminded me that I wasn't taking a long enough view, and he was correct, regarding what's going on in Egypt and the Middle East in general. You may recall shortly after his election and inauguration in 2009, President Obama went and delivered a speech in Cairo. And I had forgotten that at that speech, President Obama insisted that the government of Hosni Mubarak allow representatives from the Muslim Brotherhood, which had been outlawed in Egypt, to attend the speech. And Mubarak was not happy about that. And of course, you know what eventually happened there during the Arab Spring uprisings that took place in 2011, Mubarak was forced out of power. The Muslim Brotherhood was elected, took a majority of seats in their Congress, or at least enough to get their president, Mohamed Morsi, elected president. Then, during uprisings last year, Morsi was forced from power. The military, which supported the candidacy of the defense minister, Abdel el-Sisi, who is now the president of Egypt, assumed power, and they've been cracking down on the Muslim Brotherhood since then. The story came out this week that a telephone call recorded without the knowledge of Sisi, who at the time was still the defense minister. This phone call recorded in early 2014 between Abdel el-Sisi and two high-ranking Egyptian officials purportedly caught him slamming the Saudi kingdom and certain other wealthy states in the Persian Gulf that have been sending money to Egypt to try to keep Egypt from completely collapsing into chaos and anarchy. Not really a good thing to come out. This tape was released by a television station in Turkey that has ties to the Muslim Brotherhood. And this television station called Mekmelin, forgive me for butchering the Turkish language, which is, again, aligned with the Muslim Brotherhood, suggested that this recording of el-Sisi and the very derogatory comments that he reportedly made, and I don't know whether anyone has officially confirmed that this is an authentic tape, but the Egyptian government hasn't denied it. This television station suggested that this tape would cause a rift between the Egyptians and the Saudis. But instead, the new Saudi king, King Salman, issued a statement saying that Egypt was like his second home, his second hometown, would be visiting there soon for an upcoming meeting on Economic Forum of Gulf States, and in fact took the step of releasing all of the Egyptian prisoners held in Saudi prisons. So it kind of backfired on the Muslim Brotherhood. Apparently, the Saudis and the Egyptians saw what was going on. Again, both nations are predominantly Sunni, and so they've been very wary of the Muslim Brotherhood for a long time. The Muslim Brotherhood dates back to 1928. Hassan al-Banna was the founder. They were recruited and allied with the Nazis during World War II. And from the Muslim Brotherhood come groups like Hamas and Fatah and al-Qaeda. And in fact, if you do a Google search for Hamas and Nazi salute or Fatah and Nazi salute, you'll find many, many pictures. It's just most of them don't make the mainstream news here in the United States. There is no cultural or religious precedent for the Nazi salute. They did get it from the Germans in World War II, and they just kept it. It's just not something that we in the West are comfortable seeing, and most media outlets don't publish those pictures, but the salute is something that's used by those groups. And again, they got it from the SS in World War II. So anyway, what does this mean for relations in the Middle East? Again, don't know. The other interesting tidbit about this story is that an Egyptian official claims that the Turkish television station got a copy of the tape from an American intelligence asset. Given that we supported the Muslim Brotherhood in pushing Hosni Mubarak out of power, I guess this isn't a surprise. But the question is, if this is true, and I don't know that it is, but if this is true, then what are we doing? What is the United States trying to accomplish over there? I mean, are we trying to play all sides against one another just to keep things stirred up? And I certainly pray that that's not the case, because as I've said before, as we look at the legacy that Barack Obama's foreign policy, the legacy of Barack Obama's foreign policy in the Middle East is one of chaos and death. We have pushed relatively stable governments out of power: Hosni Mubarak, Muammar Gaddafi, Saddam Hussein, and we're attempting to do it and have mostly succeeded with Bashar al-Assad in Syria. Now, again, none of those men are men I probably would want to come anywhere near my family, but you're dealing with a part of the world where there is no loyalty to a nation state. All loyalties, for the most part, don't extend beyond family or tribal groups. It's very difficult to cobble together a nation state from people who have no loyalty beyond the people with whom they share a bloodline. Almost impossible. You need to be a brutal man in order to make it work. And we have pushed three and almost four out of power. Now, of course, we can't blame Saddam Hussein on Barack Obama. That was, of course, George W. Bush. But the fact remains that a power vacuum was created that has yet to be filled. The Islamic State is trying real hard to do it, not just in Iraq and Syria, but also Libya now. As we saw the news today, that 21 Egyptians were beheaded in Libya today, as I record this on Sunday, February 15th. And also in Iraq, images published in a British newspaper, the Daily Mail, showing 17 Kurdish fighters in cages being wheeled through the streets of Kirkuk. And I will not be surprised at all if we see more video of men being turned into human torches by the Islamic State here in the very near future. Come quickly, Lord Jesus. I don't know what the solution is. There may not be any good solution, not anytime soon. So, coming up on this program, we have got an interesting interview. Well, coming up this Wednesday, in fact, there was an article that caught my attention. In fact, the author of the article then sent me a note to see if I'd seen the article, which had gone viral. It was published at Gizmodo, which is a tech website about artificial intelligence and religion. If a self-aware artificial intelligence is created, would religion try to evangelize it? And if so, would it be successful? Would an AI have a soul? Well, there's at least one Christian pastor who was interviewed by our guest who says, sure, I'd be willing to, you know, in fact, the pastor said, I don't believe Christ's salvation is limited to humans. So we'll discuss artificial intelligence and religion with Zoltan Istvan, the author of The Transhumanist Wager and also a candidate for president on the Transhumanist Party ticket. In fact, I'm going to speak with him just a little bit later this evening, and that will be posted on Wednesday, February 18th. And then hoping that Dr. Aaron Judkins will be back to full health. He is on the mend at last report, and we'll talk with him about his participation in the forthcoming documentary, The Search for Noah's Ark. That next Sunday, February 22nd. As we get closer to the final week of the month, our schedule, again, will be disrupted somewhat. We will have movers in here beginning the 24th, and so I'm not sure how long this rig is going to be functional, and between the 24th and March 1st, we probably are going to be offline, or mostly offline anyway. So unless I can work ahead and get a few more in the can in the next few days, we may miss a day or two on The View from the Bunker and a PID radio, but we'll try to pick up the pace after that as we get on site in Missouri and begin rolling out programming there. Also on Skywatch TV, and we're hoping that we can increase our frequency with PID radio now that Sharon and I will be free to focus full time on that. Hey, if you're listening to us through Stitcher or iTunes, it really would be a help to us if you take a moment or two to leave a review. Especially with iTunes, helps to bring View from the Bunker a little better search engine result when people are looking for new podcasts to try. Number of reviews and positive reviews especially will certainly help us there. And we've got a Facebook page at Facebook. And if you go there and click the like button, we'd certainly appreciate that as well. A View from the Bunker is a production of Gilbert House, and it's released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives 4.0 International License. The opening theme is by Kevin MacLeod. His website is incompetech.com. Remember, we wrestle not against flesh and blood. Until next time, I'm Derek Gilbert, and this is A View from the Bunker.